All right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
Oh, Jay, I am so excited tonight. Let me just tell you. I am thrilled to death. That's how I am. How are you?
I'm well. Probably not as good as you, but I'm still doing.
We got the World Series going on. We got an election next week. And by God, we have got some amazing guests.
We do. But before we get to the guests, we have to do what we always do. We tell you guys to go out there. If you like this podcast, if you like listening to it, then you need to go and subscribe. You need to tell your friends. You need to leave a review. That's the big thing. Reviews. iTunes loves reviews. We love reviews. We want to hear what you have to say.
And honestly, if you've been listening to the show this long, how could you not be subscribed? I just think logistically it doesn't make any sense. Like, you would have to be subscribed by now. But if by some chance you're not, please do it. Push the button. Subscribe. Yeah. And if you haven't reviewed us, I mean, for Pete's sake, go ahead. Throw us a bone.
Come
on. A 4-star bone.
I know.
Or a 5-star bone.
Well, we're just do
some
something.
Kind of bone, please.
So we're going a little bit out of our territory here. Normally we only have one guest, but it was funny. I was listening to a song, Saint Cecilia by the Foo Fighters, the other day, and I kind of tweeted it and said, hey, this is the song we used to close out Splinter Caucus, and Amy responded, and Jeff responded, Amy Otto and Jeff Blair, and so we decided, you know what, let's have a reunion show. Let's have all four of the crew back together, and so they're here. Amy Otto is here. Hi.
Hi, everybody.
And Amy is now a resident of the Pacific Northwest. How do you liking it there?
That is true. It's rained for like 10 days straight. Certainly something.
It's awesome.
But coming from a place with a drought and like minimal showers and stuff, it's actually kind of pleasant. And I've enjoyed seasons again because I'm originally from the East Coast. So after 16 years in California, I started to feel like I was living in a terrarium. So this is actually kind of fun.
And no income tax, right?
Oh, yeah. 10% raise just showing up. It's awesome.
Jeff Blair's here as well. Jeff, of course, our Chicago native. So he's, you know, we kind of scheduled this thing. We tried to do it last night, but there was conflicts. And we were like, well, we'll do it tonight. And then I was like, oh, well, you know, the World Series is on. But, you know, we'll go ahead and do it anyway. So now Jeff is all worried, right, Jeff?
I literally am only going to be paying half attention to you. I have the radio on in my earphones here as well.
Oh,
but
okay.
I got to say, it is a pleasure to be here. It's really great to get the whole band back together. And I guess it's going to be fun to talk about the ruin of American conservatism for the next 4 years.
Yeah, the would you say the ruin of conservatism? Is that what you
said? Yes, the potential ruin.
That's a ruin of conservatism. Yeah, you know, it's like I didn't want to discuss the usual just kind of, you know, politics with, you know, the usual idiots. But I think there is kind of like a bit of a shift going on in the conservative movement. And it's kind of like this thing where it's up for grabs. Like who's going to control it at some point. Because you have differing factions within that are really, you're just really starting to see the splinter now. It used to be where those groups were all kind of come together and, you know, for, you know, in order to win, it was like, you know, there was always somebody that was going to be placated, the social conservatives versus the fiscal conservatives, you know, and then now you have the you know, I guess you would, I guess for lack of a better term, the nationalist conservatives, the ones who were, you know, railing against free trade agreements and immigration and everything like that. So it's, you know, there's a discussion to be had because something's going to change after next week and we don't know what it is. And yeah, we have a good idea what's going to happen, but of what's going to happen on election day. But the problem is what happens after that. Now, we had Bill Kristol on here last week, and we talked more about the party. We talked about the GOP in terms of what's going to happen and particular players within the GOP, that kind of thing. But this is more about, you know, the conservative movement. Is it dead? Is it going to have to readjust? Has it changed? Some people are suggesting even things like getting rid of the word conservatism, like, you know, using a different term to build a new movement or to kind of reinvigorate one that's been around for a while. And I was watching, I don't know if anybody out there is listening and you have Amazon Prime, If you're a Bill Buckley fan, you can watch episodes of Firing Line on Amazon Prime. There's so many of them, and
They're a little hard to sort through.
They are. It is difficult to sort.
After I saw that you had posted about it, Jay, I went out and I watched some, and I watched the one from 1968 with Buckley and George Wallace, and they were talking about populism, and I thought, gee, this is fairly timely. I wish we had had some sort of forum where Donald Trump could have explained his views in this manner, as George Wallace did to Bill Buckley. And if you watch it, Wallace is prickly. He's defensive. He is constantly trying to shift the subject. He's short on specifics. He's basically he's like a more polished Donald Trump. He's in the firing line, essentially. It was kind of nice to watch. It was sort of cathartic, almost, except then I realized that nothing like that happened in 2016. So, anyway, but I do recommend going and watching these old episodes of Firing Line if you want to see what an intellectually vigorous movement looks like, if you want to see what conservatism was before it withered on the vine.
Yeah, I watched the Reagan one from 1980, and Buckley took kind of like a different tack. Instead of like asking questions where it would leave Reagan opportunity to just kind of bash Jimmy Carter, Buckley took it from the perspective that, okay, you are already the president, and I'm going to ask you questions about that. You're president, what are you going to do? And I mean, he started off with like a race riot question in Detroit, and 15 minutes later, they're discussing interest rates and bonds and inflation. First of all, it was a reminder of just, you know, everybody wanted to, you know, tried to say that Reagan wasn't all that bright and everything like that. But the breadth of knowledge that this guy had to discuss all of these issues, both domestic, foreign, financial, everything. And, you know, Buckley, if you watch the show, he's not prone to asking simple questions. What do you think about this? Or, you know, tell me you're going to do this, yes or no. It's, you know, there's some detail there. There's some, you know, some nuance, and people have to be prepared. So that's why Neil was saying that Wallace probably wasn't doing all that well.
Well, there's a sort of an assumption that the audience is not a bunch of fifth grade reading level subliterate morons, as there is today in most conservative media and in the entirety of Fox News, if I will be so bold. So there's that aspect as well. The audience was expected to have done their own homework and not be spoon-fed the answers. There was a certain level of respect from the conservative elites. They were putting out this product and they expected you to keep up. And if you couldn't keep up, well, by God, keep your mouth shut. Don't opine on things that you don't have any idea, what the answer is, what the solution is. We no longer have that.
Right. But now to shift gears a little bit, and Amy, I think you saw what Ben Domenech was tweeting before, because you kind of jumped into that.
Yeah.
And
I actually think what Neil just said is very interesting. But go ahead.
No, yeah. I was going to say, and mm-hmm. you said something at the end. I'm trying to find it here. you said Trump is a terrible messenger who happens to be largely on message. He's ill-equipped to bring it home throughout his personal ignorance. He has more in common with the masses hungry for the same. So essentially what, and if you see this, I'll put this in the show notes, and Ben was kind of like doing a version of his own kind of tweet storm where he was talking about, he said the populist supporters of Trump know deep down that the nation's elites do not respect them or care for their plight or their opinions. Over and over, they've been told by the elites, you are not allowed to want that thing, and they are fed up with it. I've written about this. I said I believe that Trump has touched a legitimate nerve in some of the population who do feel kind of left out. It's just his manner of kind of going about it, and the ideas that he's expressed to solve it are complete garbage. So, Amy, go ahead and tell us what you were saying about Neil, and then what you think about what Ben was saying.
Well, I think that the two actually dovetail really well together, because I think that Neil and Ben would likely agree. Because one thing that Neil said struck me, and because I've been trying to unravel how I want to talk about this tonight, was that, in Firing Line, they talked in a way where the elites, or if you assume the people being interviewed are the elites, which I don't necessarily think was true in the day. They were just people, but they talked in a way that wasn't talking down to folks. I think, you know, just as much as maybe the average person may not be able to keep up with Buckley or Reagan, I think they appreciated the fact that they didn't purposely, like, treat them like morons. There's something to that, is that it was assumed that political discourse should be complicated, and there wasn't a need to talk down to people. I think, you know, it's kind of interesting to think of what you would consider elite speech. I actually think elites cater too much to stupidity today, unlike the elites of the past who were perfectly saying, keep up with us or don't. I think that's very interesting. And I think that Trump, the reason I kind of responded to Ben's whole tweet storm that way, is that Trump may be largely on message, but he's horrifically incapable of doing what Reagan did, which was being fluid on topics and being able to manage a populist message in a controlled manner that actually could attract a majority of electorate. And I think that's really the difference of what you have here. And it's not to ever put Trump and Reagan in the same atmosphere, because that would just be horrific to me, but it isn't, I would say it's not true that Trump hasn't hit on some things that the GOP should consider. He is just the worst person possible to possibly execute on any of it, because he doesn't particularly understand it. But it's almost like he's the masses trying to just claw enough up to share what the masses believe, but not really being capable of leading. And so that's a sad place, is that people are hungry and they're desperate for a message like Make America Great Again or something like that, which is literally a message from Reagan's campaign. They're desperate to restore culture and the providence and the virtue and the sanity that allowed conversations like what happened on Friday Night to be normal, to be how politics were discussed. Like, if you look at Trump and you get angry and you're aspiring to be back in firing line, you realize that in Trump, in his awkward, like, completely destructive, like, bull in a china shop way, is actually saying by Make America Great Again, is I want a world where that exists again. But he's just so inarticulate, he can't even get there himself. And it's a sad place. And it's very sad what the liberal elites have done to the population in this country. Is everyone used to be a lot smarter. Everyone used to be able to handle watching something like Firing Line, regardless of class, regardless of race, and keeping up. I don't know if we're that same population today, and I think that that's a bit of the challenge, but I'm hoping I'm threading a needle, because I know where Neil and I often stand on these issues, but I think I just found, like, an area where in a Venn diagram we would align and agree that there is a place we all are trying to get back to, and whether it's possible is a different question, but Trump is the most inarticulate way you could possibly get there, and he's not going to win by any means, but it's not necessarily wrong to be considering thinking about why this country is breaking down, why we can't hear each other anymore, and why we can't talk to one another effectively anymore, nor discuss issues without having offense or challenge or anger or vitriol or emotion being the primary response instead of logic or rational thinking.
True. And if, you know, that's, again, you talk about Firing Line, if you watch it, it's just this very long, detailed conversation that is kind of, you know, is really fun to watch, because it's not a bunch of yelling and screaming. It's two people talking, or sometimes there's three, a little bit more. Jeff, in your thinking about it, you know, you're kind of educated on this, and so I'm interested in hearing what you have to say. Like, What has been your observation? Say, let's go back, say, you know, just go back like 10 years, and where conservatism has gone from that point until now. Has it changed, or has just the players changed and how it's communicated, or what? I mean, what's your outlook on it?
I'm paraphrasing somebody, and I wish I could place the exact quote, but somebody once said that all great movements begin as a cause and then eventually devolve into a racket. This is pretty much the case with conservatism, as it is with almost everything else, progressivism as well. All these things, these political movements, eventually get to a point, I believe, where they tend to lose touch with what their original animating impulses were, and end up becoming a series of poses that are done either for, you know, electoral value, because they're convenient signals to voters, or because they're a good way to make money on a more vulgar level. Before I get to that, I want to actually kind of refer back to something that Amy was talking about, in fact, that we've all been referring to with respect to, you know, like watching Firing Line and, you know, like what happened to American culture ever since then. We've changed this. The entire culture of the United States, and in fact, one of my personal kind of hobby horses, is the entire culture of Western civilization has declined over the last several years. Maybe since the 60s has been on a downslope, but it's really accelerated ever since the 90s, and I would put most of the blame for that at the feet of the internet. You can blame Hollywood or sort of, you know, loosening morals and culture and things like that, but I really do think that this, the hyperconnectivity of social media, of the internet, the ability for people to find one another and to be reassured in their ignorance and their folly by finding like-minded fools to tell them what they want to hear, or cynical hucksters who will sell them lies that will, you know, make them feel better, has led to a coarsening and a sort of, you know, desensitizing of our entire intellectual and political culture. When we say that people used to watch and appreciate Firing Line, they used to watch it because it was the only game in town, more or less. You didn't have the option of going to Breitbart or reading Drudge back then. You had, if you wanted to watch, you know, political debate on a network news, I think actually Firing Line was on PBS, you basically had, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, you know, and PBS were your choices. And because of that, you know, we talk about how the mainstream media is so corrupt, and we talk about how we don't like having these gatekeepers who tell us what we can and cannot listen to. But the honest truth is, I think gatekeepers, in a certain sense, were a very good thing, because they kept a lot of idiotic rabble, rabble-rousers and babbits at bay. And look at what happens when we don't have any such controls. We get, you know, the Stephen Bannons of the world, the Matthew Boyles of the world, the Breitbarts of the world, running things and calling the shots. Rush Limbaugh is the great-grandfather of conservatism. This isn't a conservatism of any sort of intellectual power. This is a conservatism that's done basically to get ratings and to draw clicks. National Review was not run as a for-profit magazine. It was run as an intellectual journal of ideological conservatism, and that's why it always retained and to this day still retains its ideological, you know, and its intellectual cast. That was never the motive for all these websites and these radio shows and these other various grifters who try to make a buck off of angry and disenfranchised voters. And it becomes a vicious cycle where these people make the electorate that they serve stupider, dumber, and more self-satisfied and more insulated from any sorts of, you know, negative feedback that they have to force themselves to take into consideration. So I'm very pessimistic about the state of culture in the United States when it comes to politics. I think we're on a big downslope because everybody is allowed to cocoon themselves into a place where they want to feel comfortable, their safe zones. And it seems that even electoral results won't snap them back into reality. And we see Trump talking about how if he loses the election, it will be because it was rigged and it was illegitimate. Well, when you can tell yourself that kind of story, even in the face of an electoral rebuke, then you are absolutely impervious in all ways to being taught a lesson.
And don't you think, okay, so I've read through Ben's tweet storm, and I think it's soundly reasoned. It definitely makes a lot of sense when you consider these people and the fact that they voted for change and change has never occurred and that sort of thing. But if we're talking about the sort of potential for a complete loss of faith in our institutions, is it more likely, and we'll just ask both Amy and Jeff this question, is it more likely that we would see the sorts of people that are the most sympathetic Trump supporters, those 7 million men in prime working age who have dropped out of the workforce, 44% of them took pain medication yesterday, 2/3 of it prescription strength, they subsist on disability, they play video games, they watch TV, and they drink. Do we think that these men are likely to take to the streets and revolt if the election is rigged, or will they simply retreat into that comfortable, warm blanket of apathy? I will say, Amy, which do you think is more likely?
I think they're already in a blanket of apathy, so I don't think much will happen post this. Trump is just a... it's like throwing a brick over through a window, you know, and if Trump doesn't stick, they'll just try something else next or they'll give up. I think the problem is the apathy that you touched on makes them unlikely revolutionaries. If they can barely get out of their house to stop playing video games to get a job, it doesn't strike me that these are the people who are going to lead us through a revolution against the federal government. Mm-hmm. So I think it's sad to me that we're such a partisan society that we don't worry about what's happening to these young men. And that we're both parties will largely just probably move on and trying to ignore them. And we'll end up in this situation because it's very unhealthy for young men and women in our society to have a world where you can be just comfortable enough that you don't actually have to do anything with your life. And I think that's probably, you know, if the conservative movement or anything had a path forward, it's to focus narrowly on the challenge that we're seeing as a society and to just talk about that specifically and not every pet issue in the Republican Party or the movement, but to address a world where everyone's included, like take a lot of the really smart Democrat messaging and mean it, because Republicans care about community. They care about the individual. Democrats don't, but they use way better words and way better slogans than the Republican Party ever does. And we should care about men who are subsisting in their basements. We should care that someone's being left behind. I don't care who they are. We should care that black men are being shot arbitrarily by policemen. We should care about all of these things that are wrong. And there's no reason the Republican Party can't do that.
I also might point out that the revolt is going to take a different form when and if it comes than Neil seems to anticipate. It's not going to be people with guns out in the streets, rioting and trying to take on the militia that gets called out to handle them. No, the revolt is going to come in the form of things that we've seen in the current electoral cycle, voting for crazy people, making
or you look at Japan, like they're just literally not dating one another anymore. Revolt will come from just a massive cultural giving up on one another.
Well, that I feel like that was kind of what Neil was referring to when he was talking about an apathetic response. I think the revolt comes when they exercise their franchise in an irresponsible way. They vote for more Trumps. They vote for the Christine O'Donnells of the world. They make impossible demands upon the legislators that are in office that the government not function. They fall prey to, again, suckers and hucksters who are, making pitches demanding that the government
tell them that they're right.
Down. They vote for people who tell them that they're right. And by the way, this is actually never gets back to the Bible was rambling on earlier, but I mean, I assume we're going to move on to this later. This is why I think that there is a hollowness that is at the core of the current conservative movement as it is constructed, that the slogans and the nostrums that are bandied about, and I know this is something that Amy and I have discussed too in the past, are built upon an intellectual think tank version of conservatism that I actually happen to subscribe to. I'm a member of that sort of elite opinion class, and I believe a lot of what is said there, but it doesn't really have – it's no longer fully connected with the needs of the people who nominally Republican legislators and government officials are supposed to serve. And it's kind of empty, and nothing is shown exactly how empty it is, quite like the current electoral cycle where Donald Trump was able to run basically contravening all those positions. Voters
I have a follow up for both of you. Given that I think we agree that the Trump voters are unlikely to take to the streets, storm any bestial or anything like that, and put heads on pikes, that removes one of the most convincing ways to affect societal change of the sort that they would like. I think that we sort of agree that they're going to trend more towards cultural apathy and voting for ridiculous morons like Donald Trump in the future. Now, aside from the disruptive character of that sort of vote, which we have seen in the 2016 cycle, if they are not going to engage with the process and put forward serious candidates and practice the political give and take, and they are also not going to rain down violence against the political establishment, physical violence, what incentive is there for the political establishment to cater to them?
Right, and let me just add, Neil.
I want to get this answer here, though.
Now hold on a second. It's going to dovetail with yours. It's going to dovetail with yours. I just want to add, because there's another subsection of these people. It's not just the Trump voters, not just the people who are going to vote for the Christine O'Donnells. There are the hardcore conservatives who are part of, say, like Never Trump, but also feel like there's not enough fighting going on. I mean, I had somebody tell me this, honestly, when I was trying to convince this person about how Republicans have done a very good job in blocking a lot of what Obama wanted to do. But because it never actually went to a situation where there was a public fight about it, that it didn't count.
Right. That's one of the frustrating things as well. But before our guests forget my question, Jay, let's get this. Let's throw it over to Jeff.
I've already forgotten your question. What was it again?
Neil? Damn it, Jeff. No.
Amy knows.
Why should we bother catering to the concern? No. Here's the thing. If they aren't going to engage with established norms, if they're going to engage in illegitimate conduct, but they won't go to the point where they are actively being violent, which is a very effective solution to their problem. I will not shrink from saying this. If you want to solve something, it helps to shoot people. Now,
why are we going to engage with these people? I'll give you a very simple answer. Here's a simple answer, because they're warm bodies and they cast votes. There you go. That's
just like
answer.
The Democrats. The Democrats are ruthless with this. They have complete idiots who vote for them. Like, you have to have idiots if you'd vote for Democrat policies, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is how you have to build coalitions and win elections, and part of your coalition inevitably is going to be stupid people or layabouts or annoying people. And it seems like there are more of those this season than in other seasons, or at least they're louder. But yeah, you have to tolerate those people, because otherwise you don't get to 50 plus one. That's my answer, at least.
I think I'm in the same camp. Plus, like, to be honest, go and meet with these people and figure out what are their drivers. Like, what are the few things you could figure out, and you just market test them to death, that you could say to them that would make them feel like you believe them, you hear them? How do you earn their trust? Romantic when Rick Perry goes out and tries to earn the Black community's trust. I'm not sure why we don't have the same romanticism when you try and earn kind of disaffected, like, poor white voters' trust. I mean, we should care about all of them.
We've all internalized the belief that black voters and Black people in the inner cities have a real problem. But I think there's somewhere deep down in our heart, we just don't think of, you know, poor white, you know,
that's
folks
racist.
Living in the...
You know what? It's true.
I'm just telling you, the honest truth is that there is this a subconscious bias, and I think it inhabits even conservatives, that we just don't think the same way about them, whether we should or shouldn't.
And I think we need to start doing that.
The stumbling block, of course, is when the thing that these voters cite as what they want from you is for you to take some sort of leveling action against brown people in our society because they're taking their jobs.
I think that's your interpretation. I actually know Jeff and I kind of agree here with, like, where the Republican Party needs to walk, like, a line on trade and things.
Let me posit this. Mm-hmm. If you talk to them and that's what they say, what do you say in response to that? Do you say, no, we're not going to be a racist party, we're not going to do that sort of thing? Or
No, you don't say that. No, you ask them, going, your neighbor who's brown, who lives next to you, who's Hispanic, do you like them? I think you make it real for them. You go, are you really going to want to move the guy who lives next to you and the family that your daughter plays with? Are you going to move them out of town? No.
Yes, they say yes. What if they say yes to that question?
Hey, Neil, you want me to give you the most cynical answer?
I don't think that's a realistic point of view of who
I like cynical and practical answers, so I'm going to tell you what a person would actually do. They're going to do this thing called politics, okay? They're going to finesse an answer that is mostly bullshit, because you're right. Sometimes people who are voters are going to make impossible demands and impossible asks. And what you do in that case is you make them think that, yeah, I'm going to do something, I can help you, I'm on your side, I'm on your team. And then you just go do what you know you have to do anyways. And that's cynical, but that's politics.
So you lie to the Trump voters who have all along been accusing the elites of lying to them and not serving their actual interests. You tell them, oh, yes, we are going to enact these policies that will give you preferential treatment, then you will go to Congress and not do it. That is exactly the criticism that I think there are some things
that you can give them that are not, you know, impossible, and also I think are
and
good
aren't
policy.
Racist. Yeah.
I don't think there's anything. I don't think there's anything wrong with you know saying, hey, you know what, we're going to build a wall and we're going to enforce strict immigration controls. I don't think there's anything particularly un-American or problematic about that.
I think there is something problematic about saying,
and now we're going to oppress anybody with browner skin in this country. If that's what they want, then they're not going to get it. And I actually don't think there's anything wrong with telling them they're not going to get it. But you throw them bones where you can throw them bones. And because you do that, you're going to be able to construct a coalition. If you don't, you don't. And you may find it distasteful, but that's what coalitions are often about. A lot of people on either end of a coalition probably don't like the people on the other side of that coalition and don't like the things that they're required to sacrifice or give up for it. The real problem is that when one member of that coalition begins to think that they shouldn't ever have to make any compromises to keep the other members of the coalition in the coalition. That's what's happening with a lot of the more angry and crazed sort of hard right members. I think I put Cruz people in this bag as well as the Trumpers. They don't even see the need to keep the rhinos in the tent. They think, oh, well, they're all scum. And if they really want to persist in that delusion, they're going to find themselves with about 20% to 30% of the country. But the same goes for the rhinos like me. We have to realize that we have to make concessions too. And unless either of us on both sides are willing to do that, we don't have a party. We don't have a movement. We don't have any electoral victories. It's simple as that. But also, just you know, Cruz really is awful, and I think you know Neil texted us.
Stop trying to put me into a good mood.
Sweet words for Neil's ears.
Cruz is the worst sort of politician in that respect, precisely because he makes these promises that you know you can get everything you want. You have no need to compromise with anybody else. Anybody who seeks to build bridges or create a coalition, a tent that actually can win a 50+1 majority is somehow selling you or your interests out or isn't a true conservative. That is the worst sort of poison that, you know, personifies the worst of the Trumpists and the Coulterite wing of the party as well. So, yeah, he's every bit as bad, in my opinion.
I can't find anything to disagree with in what you just said, Jeff. Jay.
Now, Amy said, so I know that she's yeah. itching to say something.
I don't have as negative opinion of Cruz as everyone else on this podcast, but that's okay.
Well, neither do I. I still think here's the thing. I still think there's value in having him around, but at the same time, I do think he's got to tone it down a little bit. And if he maintains the same philosophy, but becomes more like Mike Lee and more like Ben Sasse, then you have a chance to put winning coalitions together. But if he's already looking to 2020, it's going to be the same stuff that we've heard. And I think, you know, if you look and people are in Texas are like, they're kind of, you know, over it already because they want, you know, there's from what I hear from people that I know who live there, there's a lot, you know, Texas is not, all the Republicans in Texas are not really Ted Cruz Republicans. They're more David Dewhurst type Republicans. But, you know, Cruz had this kind of momentum shift that carried him through. And they are talking about kind of, you know, having a primary challenger against him in 2018, at the very least to kind of say, hey, you know, tone it down a little bit, you know, maybe. And that's the way I kind of think about it. I think I am not, you know, if Cruz was excommunicated, Neil would sit there and have a party, you know, he'd pour drinks. I'm more with Amy. I think he's there, but I do think that he's got to, you know, it stop this. I stand alone, you know, and I'm here by myself and I'm nobody else is with me kind of thing. It's like, you've got allies in that body that'll work with you to make these kind of changes that you want. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite person probably still like default to Rand Paul or something. I mean, that's more where my personal philosophy is aligned. And I don't, you know, I have a majority of like 10% of the country who's probably behind me where my own personal politics live. But yeah, you know, but I would have been very happy this election to have run anybody who pretty much was in the primary besides Trump at this point.
Oh, God, yeah. Don't get me
you know,
wrong.
Besides Kasich, I think that might have pushed me too far. But, like, I think that's about it.
Kasich would be up on Hillary Clinton by about 15 points.
I know that is the whole thing. Kasich would win easily.
I would have felt really gross and creepy about it. But yeah, I probably it's still better than Hillary. You're right. Okay, I would have taken anyone in the Republican primary.
Except maybe. I don't think I would.
Except for Ben Carson.
Exactly. There you go.
Yeah. Okay, those are the two garbage candidates that we should have just filtered out.
Well, and that's the other thing too. Is like, you know, if we're back more talking to about party politics than the overall mm-hmm. conservative movement. But I mean, there's got to be something that has to be done next time around. That you can't have 10 people on the damn stage doing a debate. You can't. They've got to do something different. I don't know what they're going to do. I can't say, oh yeah, they should do this because that'll be easy. Because everything sounds easy. Is it a matter of can they do it? But we cannot have another circus like we had this past year, because there's talk of, like, you know, somebody wrote something that was kind of funny. It was like, well, you have Kanye West can run for president. I mean, if Donald Trump can do it, why can't one of these crazy people, entertainers, just run?
But that's Republican run on their celebrity incentive system to attract, like, every idiot who wants to sell a book versus run for president.
Exactly.
In the primary.
Yes.
That's the barrier, and they don't care. You know, they're not willing to make the changes. Like, the people who should burn aren't Trump this election. It's every idiot who gaveled him in at that freaking convention and who set these rules up to make this happen. But that's, you know, that's me, because Trump is a symptom and he's just a thing that will be excised. He's already 7 years old. We won't have to deal with this for much longer. But the problems that are endemic is an ignorant Republican Party who is not competitive nor understanding how to really take out the enemy. And that's where people get behind people like Cruz. And yes, maybe their animus and wanting to see physical action isn't channeled effectively, but they're not incorrect in saying the Republican Party has no fight or strategy or ability to beat Democrats when it comes to national elections, because that is true.
No, but there's also this part where people are not, they don't want to wait. I mean, Democrats can play the waiting game, which is what they're good at too, is that they'll sit there and they'll wait 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years before they can go ahead and do what they want to do. Whereas Republicans, too many of the people who are like, or fans of Cruz, you know, they want everything now. It's like, okay, you wanted to vote to defund Planned Parenthood. Congress voted to defund Planned Parenthood. Barack Obama vetoed it. Oh, well, then you turned around and you gave him everything he wanted, including funding. Well, again, you know, even I recognize, okay, if you strip funding out of the budget deal, he's going to veto it. The government's going to shut down. And then what's going to happen? And every time I ask people that, because even I'm not opposed to, like, a short-term government shutdown that proves some kind of point or something like that. And it can be done. And I think that happened actually back when Newt was speaker. It worked out better than the one that happened a couple of years ago. But if it's done right, if you've got some kind of game plan to go ahead. Yeah. But when this comes up and I ask people, I say, okay, the government shuts down, then what? Then we wait. Wait for what? You know, got it. What do you do after that?
Exactly.
And that's where they kind of get tripped up.
Sometimes I feel that our friends who insist on that sort of, you know, action-oriented Republican Party they haven't actually thought this through. They don't have a plan for what comes after. They seem to think that the rightness of their cause will carry the day, which human history will tell you is not the case. And I think it's useful to point to the example of, say, the conservative movement period. If you look prior to 1955, when National Review was founded, you had a long history of conservative failures. You know, just recently before then, you had Senator Taft. Thank you for typing. Defeat of Senator Taft. Then you had the founding of National Review. And then 25 years later, you had the election of Ronald Reagan. Right. And in the you know, meantime, you had the crushing defeat of Barry Goldwater, which many people thought discredited conservatism, you know, completely. And it did not. They retooled, they refocused, and, you know, they had the Nixonian interlude. Nixon was no real conservative, but they eventually elected Ronald Reagan. So, you know, that was 25 years. That's a generational effort. And some of our friends want to get everything done within an election cycle. 2 years. That's as long as the Republican Congress got to make generational change, to roll back a ruinous entitlement, you know, on par with anything we've ever seen from the Democrats.
But essentially, to be fair, that entitlement Obamacare created an intense amount of pain for a lot of people.
It surely did.
I think like you're in a bubble where it didn't hurt you. And so for folks who are hurt by Obamacare, there may be a time bound or incentive to move quickly just to counter some of this. We're all talking in a bubble, like, yeah, the government policies are terrible, but, you know, it didn't really personally affect me, so I don't really get why. Well, let's wait 25 years to repeal Obamacare. Some people are like, are you kidding me? I cannot pay for this month.
Sure. But Amy, but...
No, that matters. Like, that's why people care.
Well, sure. And so they voted in a Republican Congress, right? And the problem is that there's a Democratic president. So what did they do? Instead of voting for any of the other 16 candidates who might have been palatable to
That's
somebody
not fair,
else.
Because only 42% of the Republican electorate voted for Trump. So most of us did not.
That was enough.
No, but, I mean, I don't think you get to smear a bunch of people, and it doesn't make them any less desperate for this new entitlement.
Can't I can smear a whole lot of people.
Well, but that's fine, but you're not going to win an election just sitting back and being arrogant.
And well, but it's not arrogance. It's just a simple acknowledgement that sort of change doesn't happen in an election cycle. And the Democrats took the ball all the way.
But that's not fair. It happened in an election cycle. Obama showed up in 2008, and they've destroyed the healthcare system in this country within 2 years.
Yes, they did. And as you know, it's a lot easier to tear something down than it is to build something up. So what would we have to do? What would we have to do if we had the...
Can you have zero empathy for why people would feel a sense of urgency when their mortgage and healthcare bills start to look on par with one another?
Well, let me just say, vote with one hand and be empathetic in the other. I mean, which one do you think will be more effective? I do have empathy for people. I know people.
Not enough, apparently, because you can't get why there's an urgency or a time-bound consideration here.
But Amy, alongside the empathy is the fact that I'm just one person, and as a party, we're just a collection of individuals. We can only do what we can do, and in a system in which we have...
And that's clearly insufficient, else you wouldn't have Trump as the nominee. Like, well, you can say that, but, like, look what happened. I think your response
take it
is
to the essential. The essential fact is that anything the Congress did to repeal Obamacare would be vetoed, point blank, until 2017. And now we are not going to have that opportunity. Hillary may be open to tinkering with Obamacare. She may even entertain some Republican proposals.
If the GOP retains a Senate majority, otherwise all bets are off.
If they do, otherwise forget it. So what we have done by making...
No, I know. We'll extend this pain for about 3 more years.
We've made the perfect the enemy of the good. It is a lack of, I would say, prudence. It's a lack of forethought.
Of course, but I'm just saying, can't you understand how people wouldn't be strategic when they're facing a bill in front of them and they want change now?
I can certainly understand it, and I can also say it was a mistake not to be. It was wrong.
But I think those of us who can pay our bills can say that, and I think that's the problem.
Sure, but we all have people in our lives who do struggle. We do know people like that, and unfortunately, it's there's only so much you can do. You can tell people to vote for the Republicans because they have better ideas, but then the Republicans nominate Donald Trump, and then the Republican Party apparatus doesn't stop him at the convention when they can.
Yeah, well,
and
there you
so
go.
We throw away a historic opportunity. So, you know, it's kind of there are no easy answers. There may not be an answer to this. Is kind of where I'm going. I don't know. Jeff, how's the World Series going?
Six more outs, baby.
Oh, we're at eight.
What we'll do is we'll try and wrap up so that we can, that way everybody, because I want to watch it myself. You know, I don't want to, I love you guys, but I'd rather, I want to see the Cubs win the World Series for the first time since freaking 1908.
We're in the top of the eighth inning and the Cubs are up 6-3.
Yeah, so it's looking pretty good. Anything can happen in baseball, but it's looking pretty good. All right, So let's take a break from the party side of this for a minute and say, and here's the question though, and Amy, I'm gonna throw this one to you, and then we'll take it over to Jeff, because we've been talking about, you know, selling it. How, where do you start? Where Even if you were going to, I mean, let's take. And you pick an issue. Healthcare is your big thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I mean, it's a pain point, right, for people. So
correct. So
it's like, a good pivot.
Yeah. So beyond going to, because here's the thing, you can't just sell it to Republicans. You have to sell it to independents and everything else, some of whom are benefiting from those. There are those people that are in that sweet spot in terms of their income who get the subsidies, who are paying very little per month for their health insurance. I mean, I've seen some good plans out there, and I'm having to do this now because I'm self-employed, so I have to go. And I'm, when you fluctuate your income, when you go from one figure, say $40,000, up to $60,000, the difference is hundreds and hundreds of dollars per month.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that question. It's like, how then do we sell a replacement to Obamacare that focuses more on market principles and actually serves the public better?
I think you don't talk about market principles or any of that stuff. You talk about a majority, like you look at the electorate, you divide them into a majority, and you figure out messages that matter to each of them. And then behind the scenes, you work out the wonkiness and the policy, but you don't leave with that, for God's sakes. You look at the mom who has a policy who can't get into a pediatrician because her kid's sick and it's an obvious sickness. Oh, he's got an ear infection. I've got a leak. Like, you know, this is what happens. Like, this is why the Republican Party bugs me, because they're so stuck in the past. They can't adjust to the fact moms work. And like, okay, so the mom has to pick her up. Kid, she gets a call from daycare. Kid's sick. She's got to immediately leave work, figure that out, get the kid. She's got probably an hour to get them into a pediatrician's office. Hopefully she knows it's obvious. Get them medicine, right? We don't ever in this party, because we're so beholden to all these weird ideas, just sit there and look at it and segment the marketplace and say, what would help the majority of this country in healthcare, and design a plan from there. I think, like, and talk about it that way. Tell stories of what matters to normal people. Like, I have a sick kid and I want to get them antibiotics ASAP. Let's create a system where that can happen quickly. Let's not create one that's like ridiculous and I can't even get in to see the pediatrician who lives near me because I have this crappy Obamacare plan and only one doctor in the entire network within 50 miles takes it, which is actually the reality of Obamacare. So I think Obamacare is actually rather easy to campaign against for the majority of the electorate, which it sucks for. Yes, there are people who are benefiting from handouts, but as soon as they get a job, to your point, that makes a little bit more, they're going to suffer greatly. And that's not sustainable. And even the people who are benefiting from handouts, honestly, they're on Medicaid. They're not on Obamacare. They are likely having less choice and less doctors available to them. They're not getting the best of the best by any means. And I don't know if that's necessarily better for them. But I would start with stories, and we're just like a plan. I mean, there's no business. For all the pro-business end of the GOP, there is no pro-business plan for how they approach the electorate, which is what drives me nuts about them.
Jeff, you wanted to get in on this as well?
I don't really have too much to say, except for the fact that I think Amy is right that a lot of the business and economic rhetoric that comes from the Republican Party, it seems almost like it's tailor-made to antagonize working families and people who actually have to deal with day-to-day hardships. It's not meant to do so, but it's clear to, you know, people in blue collar and working class states like Ohio, for example, Mitt Romney lost in 2012, but it looks like Donald Trump, of all people, is going to win in 2016. That the Republican Party, with its standard economic rhetoric, doesn't really even seem to be taking their issues into consideration. That their party is for, you know, entrepreneurs, business owners,
right,
businessmen, the rich, Wall Street. Makes this very easy to caricature, especially if you're, gifted at slinging rhetoric the way the Democrats are when it comes to running elections every 2 years. So I also think there's a grain of truth to it. I think honestly, a lot of the pro-business rhetoric that emanates from the Republican Party does come from the fact that there's more than a little bit of institutional capture by interests that are, you know, big business oriented. You know, big business obviously makes its inroads in both parties. They're just as cozy with Democrats as they are with Republicans. After all, they're going to get in with anybody who could potentially hold power in government. But I really do think that a lot of times when we make our tax plans and our tax policies, we focus on cutting taxes when we should be spending more time thinking about how to make the average working American life easier. And this is actually one of the reasons that I like some of the ideas. Everybody likes to kick around reform conservatism, make fun of it, like, oh, those silly eggheads and their think tanks, people like Ryan Salam and Avik Roy and people like that and Mia Rao-Stothet. But they have a very good point when it comes to saying, listen, if you're going to come up with a policy that actually addresses the needs of real people and therefore can get real votes, you need to start thinking in terms of stuff like child tax credits and, you know, helping people deal with their child care needs and their medical bills, because this is the stuff that actually animates voters en masse. The estate tax and, capital gains cuts, that's really not what people are concerned with. And in fact, when you emphasize that during a period of hardship for other people, it almost comes across as perverse and ghoulish, like, well, you really don't care, do you? You don't get it, do you? The Republican Party is in danger of sounding like the party that just doesn't get it when it comes to the economic hardships that lots of Americans are going through these days, which is, I think, one of the reasons why Trump was so devilishly effective during the primaries. He found that weakness, maybe without even trying to. He unwittingly found that weakness, and he exploited it.
So I guess the answer is lie to the people. And
it doesn't have to be a lie, Neil. This can be good policy as well.
Well, I mean, Marco Rubio touched on that a little bit when he talked about welding. You know, and there's an article, and I wish I could find it, came out about a month ago, talking about the need for electricians, welders, plumbers around the country is like through the roof. And the mistake that he made, of course, was talking, you know, of course, the media focused on who makes more. So the next day it was all about philosophers make more than welders, which really wasn't his point. But again, it's kind of a situation where if you're going to say something, you have to say it so that the media is not going to focus on that little bitty stupid thing and make the overall larger point is that there are people who have jobs now that just who've lost jobs that are not coming back. And, you know, we talk about people lying. I mean, Donald Trump is the biggest liar who says he's going to bring all these jobs back when he's not, because they're gone forever. You know, productivity is up, but it's because of automation and things of that nature that aren't going away. It's just not going to happen.
Well, what do you do for those people then?
But that's what I'm saying. That's where you have to kind of, when you talk about retraining, and I think Scott Linsicum mm-hmm. was real good on this. He says most government retraining programs train people for the job that they already have instead mm-hmm. of something different, you know, and that's where you could take somebody who may have worked in a factory who is good with his hands. Maybe he doesn't know how to, maybe he's not a welder, maybe he's not an electrician, but you can propose something, and of course, this comes back to now you're going to get into this thing. Well, why should the government be doing this? But you know,
why should the federal government?
Why should the federal government? But
no,
at the same time,
the conservative movement.
Well,
like,
that's the whole
do
thing.
Anything to help people.
Well, that's the whole thing.
It's useless.
I know. Well, I think you have to work within the framework of what we have at this point.
It may be that we can't do anything to actually help people, short of just doing what the Democrats want. I mean, the Democrats, they certainly help people. They take affirmative action. That's not the wrong phrase, but they actually do things that help people. Whereas we sort of say we'd like to devolve this sort of thing to local decision makers. One of the solutions that has been proposed, I think, on this very program by Mike Rowe or somebody was this idea of local businesses and apprenticeships. Instead of federal government retraining programs, businesses should be empowered to be able to have an apprenticeship and pay somebody hardly anything, basically. Minimum wage laws get into this, all that sort of stuff. But it all interferes with the ability of people to learn a new trade, because it interferes with the ability to make teaching people a new trade economically viable. So what solutions can we offer?
We can paint a better story and a better world, but what you can do behind the scenes are the things we really believe in, which is massive deregulation to create those worlds you're talking about. And what I think is the problem is that conservatives, when it comes down to it, don't have the courage of their convictions. Like, we actually don't believe our policies will work, and so we're afraid to pursue them. And this is what bugs me about the whole movement is, you know, why don't we're afraid to actually create capitalism in our society. We're afraid to deregulate things because we're afraid of risk. But if this party is going to paint a future and be attractive, we have to be the party that is instilling risk and risk taking back into this country. Because if we don't do that, there's no point to the entire party anyway. And I don't care how we do it, but that has to be the entire bent and arc of what the Republican Party does in the future.
That's a great point to go out on.
It is. It is. That is going to be the final word. Because
because speaking of going out, I think the Cleveland Indians may be about to go out of the World Series. So Jeff desperately wants to get back television.
Well, though, the Cubs have four more outs to get.
Four more outs. And you know, for those of you who are not baseball fans, the Chicago Cubs have not been in the World Series since 1945. They have not won.
Everybody knows
this. Some people don't.
There's not a lot of time left. If they don't know it by now, it's too late for them.
They haven't won a World Series.
People.
They haven't won the World Series since 1908. They haven't won the World Series since 1908.
I can mute you guys and get my point across.
Let's wrap it up, buddy.
we have a question for both of our guests, and this is an important question.
Just cut to the point.
Fine. Jeff?
Star Trek.
Thank you. And Amy?
What's the question? Star Wars or Star Trek?
Which is better, Star Trek or Star Wars?
The entire franchise. The whole franchise we're talking, not just the TV show versus the movies.
It's totally your personal opinion. You don't have to evaluate it on any objective criteria. It's just, which do you prefer, Star Trek or Star Wars?
I love both. I can't choose. Oh my gosh, this is really hard. I guess Star Wars for the pure hero's journey. Sorry.
Fair enough. It's a split decision.
I'll allow the we can play the we'll play the Star Trek theme for you, Neil, because you lost the last 2 weeks.
I've lost like the last three. So,
wait, Neil, do you prefer Star Trek? Or do you prefer Star Wars?
I'm a Trek guy.
Star Trek. I love Star Trek, but that was tough.
I'm a Trek guy. I'd like to boldly go to the end of this podcast.
He likes the socialist places where no one gets paid for living.
This is a whole other show.
Which is where Star Trek's politics get to me.
The Federation is such a hypocritical, like, real politic place. It pretends to be a socialist utopia. There's a whole show behind that. But anyway, we need to wrap. I'd just like to say thank you again, Amy and Jeff, for joining us, getting the gang all back together here.
Man, my pleasure.
It's great to be back.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Great discussion. And we went, but it's about an hour. And now we have to go, ladies and gentlemen. That's going to be it for this week on I almost said Splinter Caucus. You believe that?
You miss it, Jay. You do.
The Fifth Estate. Remember, go out there, review us, subscribe to us. I'm Jay Caruso for Neil Doing. We will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.